You're listening to an audio recording of a workshop session from the Gospel Coalition's 2018 Women's Conference.
I want to welcome you to the Faith, Politics, and the Public Square panel today. My name is Bethany Jenkins. I work at an organization called the Veritas Forum, which is a faith-based nonprofit based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that seeks to put Christian worldview in conversation with other worldviews on college campuses around the country, actually around the world. Before that, I was an editor at Gospel Coalition running Faith and Work, but particularly relevant for this conversation, right after college, I moved to Washington, D.C. I worked in the U.S. Congress. I then worked at the State Department. I then did government relations at the New York Stock Exchange. So even though to me it seems a little bit like a lifetime ago, at some point I was involved in politics and public square. Although I'm behind the scenes, I'm very much involved in several organizations that go to DC and lobby and things like that. I'm excited about this conversation because I think a lot of the questions that we're here asking today, the questions of it's questions of science, theology, philosophy, is what can be known and how do we know it? And politics really asks the question, what can be done with what we know? And so that's what we're going to talk about today. What's interesting about living in the age we live in today, a secular age, postmodern age, is quite often the idea of facts are a private, or facts are the public conversation, and beliefs are a private conversation in our culture. And so faith has often been relegated to the private realm. But if you believe, even though this is an unpopular opinion today, if you believe that the Christian faith is true for all people, it's actually a public truth, not a private truth. And so that's what we're going to talk about today, is what does it mean that we believe in a public truth, not a private truth, and how do we live that out? I'm going to do this panel a little differently. I was at a retreat a couple weeks ago, and most panels you'll go to today are going to have everybody on stage, and they're going to go quickly through their introductions, and you're not going to get to know a lot about them, and then they're going to go straight to questions. I'm going to do it differently because I thought it was great, and if you hate this format, you can come complain to me afterwards, and I will never do it again. We're going to take each panelist one by one, and I'm going to interview them about what they have done in their work in this field. So you're going to get to know them and actually what their work is. They're very different. So to ask a general question actually creates some awkwardness in terms of them all having to answer the same questions. So I'm going to do one by one, and you're going to really get to know them. So I'm hopefully excited about how this goes. So first, I'm going to invite Mindy up. I think you have to turn on your microphone, Mindy. That's yours. I would love you to tell, everybody has your bio on their app or their program. So I would love you to introduce yourself in light of what work you have done in this politics and public square space.
Good afternoon. It's just great to take in this room people who want to talk politics. I am the senior editor at World Magazine. I've been writing for World for, we'll just say 20 years, and more than that. And so naturally, before I came into journalism, I was working on Capitol Hill. One of the reasons I got a job with World was because I could write about politics at a time that they were pretty desperate for writers. Politics defines public life, and if you're a journalist, you can't do much of anything without it. I have been covering mostly international news and mostly things that have been going on in the Middle East, the situation for religious minorities in the Middle East. That has been my focus. But we live in a colorful and changing world. I just came from a call from McAllen, Texas, to talk about the situation at the border. And so all of our lives, in a sense, I mean, I know you'll get to this, but politics will eventually affect us one way or another. So,
from your perspective, having covered so many international stories and even this story, what do you think most of the people here, I'm assuming, live in the United States? What have you seen as your, or many of the people, not most, what have you seen that we may be missing, that we, a perspective that we could gain from other countries that you've been working in that maybe we don't have an appreciation for?
Well, this may not be exactly what you're looking for, but here's what I think. I want to do a lot of cutting to the chase because I think that we live in incredibly troubled times in our own country where we should be really concerned about both the level of heat in our political discourse, the fact that middle ground is being lost or has been lost, the fact that it's so hard to have conversations. And so where I would go with that is just saying that I think what we've lost as Christians looking at politics and looking particularly at politics, I will say, is we've lost our privilege as believers, and that what we bring is it is that we know the end of the story, and so we ought to be able to engage very fiercely on behalf of the vulnerable, on behalf of the disenfranchised. Let's just put it that way. The other thing is we've lost our perspective, our responsibility. I would say our privilege and our responsibility. Responsibility being that, you know, First Peter 4 talks about we have the front row on Judgment Day, and those who do not know the Lord are behind us, and I think there's real accountability that comes with being on the front row. And so so I think that just having that perspective that gives us a willingness to risk something, I'll put it that way, whatever that looks like, whether we're in our small towns or our big cities or on Capitol Hill or wherever we are.
Just to get real tangible, have you had any stories that you've covered or that you've almost covered or that would actually be an example of, inspiring example of something like that?
Well, it's interesting because I feel sort of a new risk in the Trump era because not only are we a divided country, but we are a divided church. And I'm fielding, you know, what I think could be called hate mail on a regular basis and have been... I'm learning how to do that. We decided early on we would respond. We have a policy of responding to mail, and so that we would respond to that mail too. And we're all learning what it means to be gracious and to lean into each other. We need the support of our colleagues to do that. A couple of things would be. I feel that every area that I've been working on, having covered, for instance, persecuted believers in the Middle East, and now having an administration that has pledged to do more than the previous administration to help them, and in fact the numbers, and I'll talk about this in one of my later workshops, don't show that. And so it's been very interesting to do stories reporting on that. We've reported on 100 Iranian Christians who are trapped in Vienna right now, do not have visas to stay in Europe, were promised visas to come to the United States, but now they've been denied. And that has been a situation that, you know, requires contact with the State Department, contact with Homeland Security, and all those things. So that's where all of it kind of, you know, and there are any number of examples. These are kind of minor policy issues in one sense, but it's where advocating on the basis of human rights and religious believers actually takes you right into the middle of politics.
Mm-hmm. This is my last question for you, and then I'll move to Trillia. What do you feel like your vocation is in this space? How would you describe that?
Well, I'm not saying this because I'm in a room full of women, but I had a few moments a long time ago of learning, and actually on the field in the Middle East and other, in Afghanistan and places like that, that I approach it as a mom. I think sometimes we try to be like the policy analyst or the reporter journalist, or that, but in fact we are not divided people, and I had to come to terms with the fact that. Whatever situation I walked into, I didn't stop being the mother of four children. However far away I was from them, I didn't stop caring about what was happening to them, and that it was directly influencing how I saw things. And I think that's a good place to be. I think that women have a vulnerability that comes from our own physical vulnerability, and that comes from the vulnerability we have as the caregivers of children, that gives us an appreciation for the human cost of our decisions. I'll put it kind of broadly that way. And so I think that we should be women. We should be, you know, a long time. I work in a man's world a lot and try to be, you know, kind of up to the task of being in a man's world. But I quit doing that. I'm freely a woman in my political
engagement.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. But we will have you back up.
Good. Did I pass?
You passed. She'll be back. Now it's Trillia to the gauntlet.
Don't gong me or whatever. I'm so much louder than Mindy.
So I would love you. This is Trillia Newbell. Her bio is in the book or in your app. I would love you to tell us about why this panel. What do you see your engagement in this in politics in the public square?
Sure. Well, I'll start with I have a degree in political science, but don't tell anyone because I do not want to write about political science. But that is my degree. And I got into law school and thought that's the trajectory. I was going to be in DC doing law. That's where. But then all of a sudden, and I frankly, to my dismay, I felt a call to full-time ministry. And I thought, no. But the Lord kept pulling me that way, and I thought, okay, I'm
gonna. At least you did it before law school, because mine was after law school. It was a very expensive call.
Yes. Yes. I'm thankful for that. That my husband and I thank God for that too. Yeah. But anyway, so yes, I started and did campus ministry full time. I was a full time evangelist, but I always had and continue to a bit of activist in me. So even then, I would talk about things like race, for example, which is something we can talk about in a sec. But and I was just always engaged in what was going on in the culture. So I got married and started working for nonprofit organizations, specifically in urban areas for kids. And then I had children, and I continued to do some freelance. I would write, what do you call those things? Grants. And
I was going to say op-eds because I had no idea where you were going.
Grants and various things to help. But then I started, I was a journalist in college, just did a few. But then I started writing for my local paper in Tennessee and did freelance journalism. My beat, if you want to call it that, wasn't on politics, but I would do feature stories that could include all sorts of things. And from there, I continued to write from a Christian perspective. And it wasn't on politics per se, but it was on culture and how culture, obviously, it's not one and the same, but they intertwine in so many areas. So I would write a lot about race and culture, and then also about the dignity of women and culture, sexual abuse, which and assault, which is the next panel, but I experienced. So I would write about that and about the unborn. And I have a whole life pro-life ethic, so unborn all the way to when we are buried. I think that's important. And so as I started writing more about these things, Dr. Moore, Russell Moore, caught wind of me. We hadn't met, and I was moving to the Nashville area. He had just become the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and out of nowhere contacts me, Philip Bethencourt, his vice president, and offers me a job. And I said, what? And then, are you sure? And the job was to be the consultant for women's initiatives. So I was going to be thinking about how can women engage in culture? How do women engage in politics? And how can we equip the church in that regard? But as my role continued, they clearly saw that I didn't just focus on women. They never asked me to just focus on women. So I am now the Director of Community Outreach for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. For those of them about this commission, blah, blah, blah. It's a very long title. It's ridiculous. But that's what I do. And I'm a wife and a mom to two little babies. And I speak and write and think a lot about race in particular, and then women in culture and women in a whole life pro-life ethic. And then I, on my own, in my own ministry, it's women in discipleship. So it can be about fear, or it's really broad.
I would love to know, since you've been working with women in this space, what challenges or hesitations do women in particular have when entering political conversations or political engagement? Are there certain things that women struggle with that are possibly unique, since you were working with women to do that? I didn't know if you saw any.
I think fear would be, so a lot of women are, or from what I gather and what I've spoken to, are afraid of the future, what in the world is gonna happen, afraid of the unknown, but also afraid of sounding stupid. Like they don't, especially in the circles that I am in, which can a lot of times be moms with young kids who are drowning with their young kids. And so it's hard for them to keep up with culture and hard for them to keep up with everything. So so we have podcasts I've suggested and et cetera, so that you could just even get a little bit. I listen to, even myself, I listen to NPR in the shower. I guess that's TMI, but whatever. And I do. And so, and just so I can keep up with, we've got World Magazine here. So we just, it's just, we want to keep up with what's going on. And so for a lot of women, it's fear and unknown and having a hard time keeping up with a fast-moving but kind of secular, mm-hmm. don't you think? It's mm-hmm. like the same thing all the time, just another day.
Just read the book of Judges, actually.
Yeah, read the book of Judges. There you go. Yeah.
I would love to know, as you've engaged different types of people in getting more engaged, I would love to know how you overcome some of those fears. Like, so you're recommending some resources, but it doesn't seem like resources is the problem. Like, how do you, what's the advice you give if someone is afraid? I saw some of y'all nodding your heads like, I am afraid, I am afraid to feel stupid. What is the advice or courage that you, or theology that you give to help people overcome that fear?
Well, if you're afraid to engage, I would go straight to Proverbs, where it says, the fear of man lays a snare, but those who trust in God are safe. So that would be my heart for you, is that you would know that you're safe with the Lord. So ultimately, we are safe. If you're afraid of just because of knowledge, I would say read a book. be equipped. Because the more that we know, the better we can fight that fear. So read, and proximity changes everything, right? So get to know people, who are engaged in these topics in various ways. And that doesn't mean politicians, that means the refugee down the street, right? So that you can better understand what she is going through, what he is going through, and you're gonna be much better equipped to speak to when you see your Mexican neighbor get carted off because he forgot to pay a bill. This is a real life situation that happened that I'm aware of. He forgot to pay something and now he's been deported and in jail. Well, he's your neighbor, right? So it just changes things. Proximity changes everything. So I think for us, we have to get to know people, read, and then fight fear theologically through the scriptures and knowing who our God is, and that God is the God of this world. He brings kings to nothing, so we can trust him. We are in this world, not of the world. So we have something. We want to be active in this kingdom, but we have another kingdom that we have to look forward to. So those are just a few off the top of my head thoughts.
And I would add, too, about reading. One of my friends has a quip. He says, read widely and read wisely.
Yeah, that's
And
good.
I think I've lived in D.C., New York, and now Cambridge, Massachusetts. I've been a conservative minority for 20 years. And so, you know, for the past couple of years, I've been one of a handful of people of friends who actually understand both sides of the argument and have empathy. I think it's really important for Christians to read the New York Times op-eds, even if you disagree, or, you know.
That's extremely wise advice, to read widely and wisely, because I do think if you're going to love your neighbor as yourself, you have to have empathy. And you can speak into culture with one-sided and complete, but as Christians, we are ruled by something, someone else, right? So we want to engage in a different way, speaking truth in love, loving our neighbors, serving, having that mindset as we're learning and engaging in the culture. So it's different. We have a different call than just saying what we think.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is my friend Stephanie Summers. Her bio's in the app and the program. I would love you to tell us who you are, and especially as it relates to the work that you're doing.
Sure. So in my bio, it says that I'm the CEO of the Center for Public Justice, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what the Center for Public Justice is or does.
Or what a CEO is or does.
Oh, heavens, I was just joking about this with someone else, and I said, you know, on the days where everyone else is out of the office and an intern comes to you and says, hey, I don't know how to plunge a toilet, and you're the only adult here, you plunge the toilet,
yeah,
and you teach
right.
them how. So the Center for Public Justice is a independent, not partisan, Christian, civic education and public policy organization. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we equip citizens, in particular Christian citizens, for political engagement, and we work with government officials, some who are Christian, others who are not, to help them uphold government's very important responsibilities. I can unpack that
yeah.
as much
How do you
as
equip?
Bethany forces me to.
That's the first question.
Yeah, well, let me say one more thing
okay.
first. So Trulia got up here and basically said, don't tell anyone I have a political science degree. I want to tell you that I have a degree in poetry. And here's why it's important that you know that. Nothing about what I know is something you cannot learn. It is so important that we as Christians take seriously our citizenship responsibilities before God. Right now, you probably have a very, very small backpack, and you have maybe two tools that you think of, right? Like vote is one of the tools. And you also probably have a whole bunch of junk in your backpack that maybe you need to like leave behind if you're gonna go to a journey for the new future of how we do this well in a pluralistic society. And I would just say that you are able right now to be people who are equipped. You don't need to go get a fancy degree. You don't need to be a person who thinks of yourself as an expert. And I would encourage you to think about that at the level of things that are proximate to you right now. I appreciated the comment about proximity so much. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. So let me answer your question.
Yep. How do you equip?
So Bethany, you know, like, is a lawyer, so she's going to, like, get at us if we don't. So for folks who are maybe starting where some of you are, right, and I don't presume, some of you are probably expert level on this right now, so but folks who are just starting out, we run several different equipping opportunities that you can run as small groups within your communities or congregations. One touch point that we do right now is groups based on education. We're an organization that does come from a perspective, and our perspective is that parents are primarily responsible for the education and nurture of kids. That has implications for public policy, but most of the world actually agrees with that. That's actually protected in the UN Declaration of Human Rights. The United States is one of the only countries that doesn't really kind of agree with that perspective. So we actually have a whole thing helping Christians think about what does it mean to be people who look for educational flourishing within the context of communities that respect the responsibilities of parents and families, that helps at the same time wearing citizen hats to think about the education in one's own community, as every kid needs to have an education that is good. And let me draw a distinction, right? We walk around a lot in society as the church, as God's people, trying to solve problems through mercy ministry. And that's a good thing, right? Kids in the local schools in your neighborhood need food this weekend. Backpack Buddies matters, right? Kids in your local area need tutors because often their parents have low language attainment and are not able to help them understand their assignments. So they need those things. But at the same time, there's some system things that could be changed. So I'll give you a concrete example. Discipline policies in schools that disproportionately invite Black young men to become criminal justice system involved when they are in elementary school, right? The decisions about those discipline policies are being made by seven people who are elected or appointed in your community. So when you vote, if you skip that section of the ballot because it's not your kid, you've basically said, good luck, neighbor. And we would argue that part of neighboring well means loving your neighbor through politics, right? So we do these equipping on this Christians Investing in Education kind of initiative. We also, many of us share a lot of concerns about the discourse. I really appreciated Mindy's conversation about the divisiveness within the church itself. We don't have the habits. I mentioned the junk in our backpack. We've got a lot of it. So we have a small group curriculum that folks can use. We have small group coaches that walk alongside you to help us think about ourselves as Christian citizens in a pluralistic society where we work together with folks who don't all agree, even in our groups, but we agree at the matter of faith. We don't necessarily agree on the matter of prudence or what that means for public policy, but we agree at the level of Christian principle, right? All lives have equal value, right? Those kinds of principles. We practice habits together in the group, deliberating, speaking civilly with one another, respecting, hearing other people's stories. We actually make people do what's called a political autobiography in the second session. So everyone has to tell, like, how did you get this way? So when I give my political autobiography, I say, I cared about politics before I was a believer. I became a believer when I was 17. But when I was 4, my mom volunteered at the polls every year. So I saw what year's election mattered to people, right? I thought it was awesome because I could read all day, right? Nobody made me go play outside. But it was heaven. The reason that, finally I got to an age, probably when I was 7 or 8, I started asking, like, why are we doing this? And my mother had actually studied to be in the Foreign Service, and she started talking to me about election integrity, right? Free and fair elections and why it mattered, why people died to vote, those types of things. And I started to understand what it was to be part of a democracy where people who are in the minority are not run roughshod over by the majority because we have a system that allows for that participation and allows for dissent and minority views and protects them. So protects freedom of religion. Those types of things. Yeah. That would be part of my political autobiography. Someone else might have a very different one, right?
When I was 13, my dad took me to a developing world country. My dad's a lawyer.
Yeah.
My dad's a lawyer for, I'm the fourth one. And we went down there to basically buy someone out of jail.
Yes.
You could literally buy someone out of jail. Yeah. And we went down there and that's what we did. And that's when I started thinking through, this seems a little unfair.
Yes.
That people who know wealthy people have, right, you know, better chance to,
yep,
you know, get,
yep,
out.
We also publish, so in addition to groups, if that seems like too deep a dive, we also publish a ton. We run a journal called Public Justice Review. It's online. You can also get a paper version of it. And we have a special initiative for young adults. We were watching young adults basically decide that the political discourse in our country is a reason for them to check out of the faith. We don't know each other well, but we share a campus ministry staff person background. So I walk around in the world with this hunch that, like, college students change the world, right? But when I started doing the research about these things, I really found out, okay, my hunch is right, so that's good. This inflection point. So we really see this critical window, so we invest a lot of resources into equipping young adults in particular. So that initiative is called Shared Justice, and we work within the context of college and university campuses with Christian Studies Centers, with the Council for Christian Colleges and University Schools as well.
One question, and then we can invite everybody back up. If I were sitting in the audience right now, I would be wondering, okay, all the information that you just shared about basically like discipline in schools, I don't know how to access the people's opinions who matter to even have an informed vote.
Yeah.
Where do you get that kind of stuff for the local level?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. So I used to have a boss that said every challenge is an opportunity. The opportunity you have. So one, within the context of just kind of the theological piece, it's really easy for us to think about the church as a body where we have different gift sets. It's not hard for you, if you knew me well, to say you definitely should not serve on the singing worship team. You make a joyful noise, but you shouldn't lead us in our joyful noise. But it's harder for us to think about our kind of civic responsibilities, and in particular our political engagement, as one where we're going to bring different gifts. And because within the context of the church body local, many church leadership teams are very concerned about politics being divisive, and so they don't really want to talk about it at all. And so you probably actually have folks in your congregation today who serve in public office, whether they're elected or appointed. Those people are often a wonderful resource. So, you know, I was describing these kind of political discipleship groups that we, have as a resource. You know, a group was trying to define an issue, and their big concern in their community was this increasing number of homeless folks in their community, and in particular homeless women and children, and no increasing kind of available resources, right? And they discovered, as they were sort of mapping out all the things they didn't know, that when they started to think through who we need to know, that 7 of the 9 people they needed to talk to were in their congregation. And so it was a wonderful opportunity for that piece. I think the other place is, it's really actually not super difficult to have conversations with public officials. And I think about this even at the level of your local public school board as a place. These organizations are not always great about putting information on their websites, right? They're doing, just like, you know, your mom and pop faith-based nonprofit, they're also busy doing their mission. So the web, you know, they don't have a big snazzy web designer putting updates on there regularly. But if you're able to be persistent in trying to have discussions, showing up for public meetings, taking turns, and you know, even in these political discipleship groups, when folks break up research tasks, they break it up to pretty small micro tasks to become informed on an issue. I would think about this today because it's June 15th. So if you think about the timeline between now and November within the context of your local community, it's actually quite a good amount of time that you have to do some homework together in your community.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. You can stay.
I can stay.
I'm just going to ask a couple questions, and then maybe even just one, and then I'm going to open it up to you guys. These are the harder questions, because they're not the story questions. I would love you guys to talk about, on the one hand, we do not live in a theocracy. So we are not trying to enact the biblical principles to what the law is. So some of that is harder to discern. So we have ideas about pro-life, you mentioned. But at the same time, I doubt anyone in this room would want to lobby to Washington that we should enact the death penalty for blasphemy, you know, or disrespecting the Sabbath, which is actually an Old Testament law as well. So we're not a theocracy, but at the same time, we are called to engage as we are Christians. We can't separate that. I would love for you guys, the tension between that is there's a lot of room for disagreement and discussion, I think, but I would love for each of you to kind of give your thoughts about how you personally think about the biblical what does the Bible call us to be, or call me, you know, maybe yourself to be, but living between that tension? I start off with the easy one, and then I'll just go.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll start, but the we are citizens, right, of heaven, but we are called to walk out our faith here as we wait. And so if I understand your question right, how do I apply my faith in politics?
How do you think about that tension and living in that tension?
I'm thinking of Romans, is it 13, where we're called to be submitted to the authorities, yet I am ultimately called to be submitted to God. So if there is something that I am, that I wouldn't agree with, I'm going to fight. I'm thankful for, just to be, give a tangible, I'm thankful for the civil rights movement. If there's an unjust law, we're going to fight it. And so I think I would qualify myself in that category where I'm thinking, okay, I'm submitted to the Lord. I'm submitted, and as a citizen of the United States, I'm also submitted to the authorities around me. We have police, etc. But ultimately, I will give an account before the Lord. And so if I see something that I see in Scripture that is clearly unjust, that it is, then I am going to speak, act, vote, go to my school, but whatever it is, the God has given us means, specifically in the United States, I'm speaking very, just for our cult, our, where we are right now, various means to be active. And so for me, the tension really is, what does God's word say? And how can I walk out my faith in a manner that's worthy of the gospel, knowing that my account ultimately is to the Lord. And so I'm going to fight things that I see that are clearly unjust if I see it in the Scriptures. There are some things, there's a lot of things that
I'm
going to really
actually
gray.
I'm going to ask you to stop you there, and I'm like, I actually want a very this is a tough question.
Okay.
I'm going to give you an example. Yeah. So I definitely have friends who would say, why would Christians fight against gay marriage as a law? That it, maybe you can think that as a Christian in your church, but we are not a Christian country. And gay marriage is a fine state, it's a state or national, you know, institution that can be, so I'm not asking you that necessarily, but like maybe if Stephanie wants it, or I would love to know, how do you live in that tension? Would it be okay? Or how would I think through, this is personally important to me because of my faith, right, but yet should this be a law that our country should have?
So,
which should be a law?
Yeah.
Gay marriage, pro-life, same kind of thing.
Law. I mean, there, but
yeah.
I was, which way?
So I am, you could say the same thing with abortion. I am personally pro-life. But do I think that it's healthy for the country to ban abortion? Because I don't live in a theocracy. We are not enacting a Christian, we don't live in Rome. I mean, right. You know, so what is the tension there?
So there's a huge tension there. Yeah. And we could talk till tomorrow about this and not plumb the depths of it sufficiently. So let me offer maybe three things to think about. And they all start with P, so you'll be able to remember them. One is principle, and I would just sort of offer this as counsel that as God's people, we do have an opportunity to think through scripture-informed principles for what is the good.
Right.
This sounds kind of elementary, but it actually really matters. And I would encourage us to not just think about these things individually. Now, if you are, you know, many people are raised basically like, don't talk religion and politics because it's rude. And I joke around, I'm like rude for a living. But the reality of needing to actually work these things out in conversations with other believers is really important. A concrete example about like a principle would be, you know, so I talked, there's ways that we could talk about this theologically. I'm going to use shorthand and say all lives have equal value, right? I spend a lot of my time talking with people who are not believers as well, helping them try to understand. So me saying human beings created in the image of God or the Imago Dei is like my first thing out of the gate is not, doesn't translate. So I try to shorthand it another way and then eventually explain more about why I believe that all lives have equal value. If that's a baseline principle for Christians that we believe is true, that comports with what we would look for in the context of a political community, right? Thus, we would say then, my second P is prudence. So this is kind of like the prudential judgment, which sometimes has to change because society isn't static, right? So sometimes the right thing to do in that moment might need to change. When you're talking about something like all lives have equal value, and then what that means for public policy, sometimes that one doesn't change. So concrete example, in this society thus far, we have continued to decide that people who make no positive economic contribution to our nation are worthy of protection. We don't kill them. We don't let them die in the streets. We both have a robust social safety net that is private action, families, incentivizes family care, and also public policies that incentivize their flourishing and protection when there are no other caregivers for them. That is directly based on folks in wearing hats as citizens saying, we are going to be this type of a world, right? This type of a nation. And that's distinct, that if you've traveled internationally, you actually know there are countries where literally it's shame upon your family if you have a disabled family member, and they do die in the streets. And there is no social safety net if their families have rejected them. Or there is euthanasia, or there is abortion as kind of the baseline for what we do with folks who will never make a positive economic contribution. You know, principle, economic contribution isn't the thing that matters. They have inherent dignity and worth, right? Prudential, okay, there's all kinds of policy conclusions and how we get the balance right. Those pieces can change. And then there's the last thing, which is pluralism. So I used that word earlier, right? We live in a society where we disagree at the level of worldview all the way down with some of our neighbors, right? We're very different. There's nuance in how the church understands things. We don't all agree about a whole bunch of stuff. But there's also nuance in the way there's a lot of texture in the larger society. So I'm making a claim that all lives have equal value, and I hope that all of you agree with that claim as believers. But some of our neighbors would not agree with that claim. And we have to then, as Christians, contend for the good. We should not be people who sort of say, oh, well, society is, you know, going down the toilet because some people believe this, but instead make a principled case for why we would believe this and help people see that that is something worth upholding and protecting. I think that there are far more complicated questions, and within, you know, even to speak to your specific question, right, even the questions about, you know, do we work for action to fight same-sex marriage as the law of the land, or do we put effort or energy into coming up with compromises that help protect religious organizations and the basic civil rights of LGBT persons, saying marriage, no marriage, not my marriage, is a civil right. Marriages are not civil rights right now. How do we do this well? Christians are going to disagree about those things. And certainly within a pluralistic society, there are folks who are going to say, no, religious organizations should have no security to fill in the blank. And we would say it's worth arguing that even if Christian or other think religious traditions more conservative than any of us in this room, not Christian traditions as well, should have the protection of the government to not force them to do things against their conscience as an organization.
I have one more question, and then if you guys have some questions, and I know we're running a little late, maybe Mindy could we're fine. Maybe Mindy could start with this one. One of my friends voted for Donald Trump, and I'm not going to make this a Trump question. One of my friends voted for Donald Trump, and another friend, when they were having a conversation, she said, well, you know that I voted for Donald Trump, and my other friend said, I know, and I've forgiven you for that. And my other friend, that's very interesting, there was a sin against you, but also just a sin in general. And it made us talk about how do you actually live in this tension? And we want to make moral decisions. Like, we want to be driven to make a decision based on our morals, but we don't want to then be morally superior to someone who has a different conviction. So how do you live in that tension by literally making a moral, feeling like it's a moral decision, but not judging someone else, thinking you're morally superior?
Yeah, I think, first of all, we were using this phrase, living in the tension. How do we do that? I think, first of all, let's just acknowledge we're living in the tension. And I think it does actually help us to realize that in this life, we are going to live with some tensions, and that we get ourselves tied in knots when we try to escape those. So while we're living in those tensions, and getting to your friend and moral superiority, the theologian John Stott talked about politics as the art of community and the science of government. And I think often we're good at doing one or the other, or we focus on one or the other, and we get really caught up in, let's just say on marriage, we get really caught up in the particulars of what that battle that we've just come through looked like in the state-by-state laws concerning marriage. And now looking at religious protection, we're real caught up in the technicalities of it. But I, every morning, walk out on a street. My neighbor, who is one of my dearest friends next door, her daughter has now come out as a lesbian, and her daughter is like a member of my family. And I have gay couples living over here and down here and up there. And in between are all people, I think we are probably a family of one, who have embraced the culture that is telling them they have to be okay with this. And what I see as I do the art of community is that as I talk to them, they're not really okay with it. They really are under a lot of pressure to accept it. And that's very difficult to get at, but that's where we can have conversations. So I think this, that tension that that Stott described so well is where we try to divide our view of politics. And I think we, as Christians, God has asked us to obey Him. We're hearing such good teaching on that. And also has asked us to be good neighbors. And sometimes that means being gracious and laying down our lives and laying down our opinions and our agendas. I think, too, and this gets a little bit of the last question, but I think helps us in this tension, is that we have to clarify why, for instance, we might say that gay marriage is a bad idea. Do we say that it's a bad idea because it undermines the church and undermines us as a group, or do we say that it's a bad idea because we believe it it is not what God intended? And where I'm trying to go with that is that I think sometimes I think that if the gospel is good for me, it's good for all of you in this room. And then it's also good for those people who try to be morally superior or inferior, or find themselves inferior. And if it's good for all, then we have a really good ground for our advocacy, our political engagement, being from the standpoint of these Christian principles aren't just good because they're Christian principles. They are good because they're life-giving. And so I think where we are now, say, on the marriage debate, is that that battle, essentially from a legal and a political standpoint, is lost if you're someone who believes that it's wrong for men to marry men and women to marry women. But God has not stopped working, and the fruits of gay marriage being the law of the land, are now what we are going to begin to see. And over the next generation or two or three, there is going to be all kinds of outworking of where we are politically as a country right now. And what we need to be thinking about is how we're equipping, you know, the students that you're working with and people down the line for how they will engage when what we know from God's word is not his design starts to fall apart and starts to harm our country. And that's where we begin to have the next kind of engagement and so kind of some moving beyond.